KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum, programs such as police crisis intervention teams and mental health or behavioral courts are set up to help steer the mentally ill away from being criminalized and to help them find treatment. How are these programs faring and what kind of impact are they having on public safety and public health and on incarceration? We focus on the mentally ill and the criminal justice system in the hour ahead with your calls and emails after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's forum. According to the Federal Bureau of Justice statistics, 1.25 million men and women with debilitating disorders are incarcerated rather than receiving needed medical health treatment. The deinstitutionalization of mental illness that occurred in the 60s, along with cutbacks in federal mental health funding and changes in the legal code on patients' rights, have increased the number of police encounters with the mentally ill, and there simply are not enough places or services to accommodate them. Police are, of course, the first responders, and programs designed to train them better, such as the CIT or crisis intervention teams, pioneered, by the way, in Memphis back in 1988, are having considerable effect, and so are the so-called mental illness or behavioral health courts, like the one established in San Francisco, where the mentally ill are steered toward treatment rather than toward being incarcerated. In this forum hour, we want to focus our attention on the mentally ill and the criminal justice system and programs designed to help police, the community, and most of all, the mentally ill. And let me tell you who is joining us in studio. Kevin Pooler is schizophrenic. He's had several run-ins with the police. He now talks to the police and works with them in training seminars about what it feels like to be mentally ill and confronted by them. Welcome to the program. Good morning.
Good morning.
We also want to welcome Mary Morgan, who is a judge with San Francisco's Behavioral Health Court, part of the San Francisco Superior Courts. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Michael.
And Greg Sancier is also with us in studio. He's with the San Jose Police. He's an officer there, works with Crisis Management Unit, and has a PhD in clinical psychology. Good morning.
Good morning.
And Mark Gale is joining us by phone. He chairs the Criminal Justice Committee of the National Alliance on Mental Illness in California and joins us from Southern California. Mark Gale, glad to have you aboard here. We're going to hook up with Mark Gale. I'm introducing him, and he's not with us, but he will be shortly. It's not easy to imagine the experience of someone schizophrenic being confronted by a police officer, but at a recent training session aimed at teaching law enforcement to better deal with the mentally ill, a group of sheriff's deputies and police officers from Santa Clara County tried to do just that. And what they're doing, what you're about to hear here, is simulating the cacophony of multiple voices in the head of someone who has schizophrenia. It's what mental health professionals say a schizophrenic might be hearing when a police officer is trying to give simple orders.
All right, so draw a square.
This person is evil. The devil has sent this
person. Draw a second square, placing his right side at the midpoint on the bottom of the first square.
Let's talk to those the next level.
Draw a third
square. Kevin Pooler, are we hearing something like what it sounds like?
A little bit. I have only heard voices on rare occasions. Every time I've heard voices, they've been making accusations or using extreme profanity. I don't think what we just heard was relative to what I've experienced, but close to it.
Well, let's talk about your experiences. I mean, the first run-in you had with the police, you kind of thought you had magical powers almost, didn't you?
Yes, there was that going on. You're so confused and you're so sick that, at least in my case, I thought that the television was able to communicate telepathically with me. I thought other people were able to read my mind. A lot of times you're not sure which voices are actually being heard and which ones aren't, and a lot of the times you're so confused that you're just misinterpreting what people are saying to you. You know, almost every word has more than one definition. So when you become sick and confused like I was, you start using the wrong definitions for the words when they're meant to be used in a different way.
You have a pretty clear memory of what the delusions were, the confusions were, even now that you're not at all delusional.
It's hard to speak of because, you know, being so sick and being so confused, it's hard to speak of it logically and to try and make sense of it because it's just complete and total utter confusion.
And when the police come into the, it becomes even more confusing, I imagine.
Especially if like me, you're having delusions about the government and about the military, and you see people wearing guns, and you start thinking they're a part of it and things like that.
So, what do you tell police officers? You've been working with them and actually helping them to understand and be more empathic. What's the best wisdom or advice you offer them as you see it?
What it comes down to is I essentially tell them to be nice, and in relaying that, I tell them that, to imagine that whoever they're approaching is, imagine that your cousin or that your niece or your nephew or, someone in your family, and just understand that they're really confused. They may be violent, or they may be exhibiting other characteristics, but at the end of the day, they're just really confused people.
And Greg Sincere, you've got a PhD in psychology. A lot of police officers out there don't necessarily have the kind of education you have. They have to make very quick decisions about just how to handle this, and that presents some pretty formidable obstacles, particularly in moments of crisis like we're talking about.
It absolutely does, and what we try to do with our training is demonstrate to officers that with the training that we provide in the CIT Academy, that our department is very forthcoming with allowing officers to take more time to make assessments on potentially violent situations. So we try to give them the training that will enable them to come in and figure out, if family members are there, certainly we try to gain that kind of information. But sadly, unfortunately, when we respond to the scene sometimes, we don't have enough information going in. So the CIT training provides certain indications of what someone might be suffering, such as in Kevin's case, if he's having hallucinations or delusions and the person's talking to themselves, we try to teach the officers perhaps maybe to go in very low key as opposed to coming in and too aggressively, and to try to come to a position where we can calmly address Kevin and make sure that we're trying to understand what's going on with him.
And the crisis intervention team training involves about 40 hours, is that right?
Yes, and we just recently completed our 22nd, and now the San Mateo County Sheriff's Office has done several. I know they do it in San Francisco, Ventura County Sheriff's Office, Placer County, and Santa Clara County has recently just had their first as well. So it's a paradigm shift that's occurring now in law enforcement throughout the United States.
And involves destigmatizing mental illness, which is a big, big factor.
Actually, it absolutely does. And that's one of the things that we try to ensure that our officers understand, is that on any given day, part of my duties in my unit is addressing officers that have certain psychological issues that may come up. Maybe they're in an officer-involved shooting, or maybe they've suffered the death of someone in their family, as just happened to one of our officers recently. So it became very clear to me early on, being a member of the crisis management unit, that we all have certain periods of our life that lead to certain amounts of depression or mental health conditions that we have to address.
Talk about the tape we just heard. Is that the sort of thing, as you understand it, that officers need to hear in order to understand? Is it illuminating for them?
Absolutely. And actually, the second day of our training is a panel visit day, a luncheon where I had the honor of meeting Kevin and his dad, Gary, at our panel day. And Kevin came in willing to try to help. It was his way of trying to ensure that people have an understanding of what schizophrenia is for him. But we also have other family members that present. We also team up with a partnership with NAMI, National Alliance for Mentally Ill. And hello, Mark, I know you're listening. In our county, it's Sharon Roth, who's retired president, and also John Mitchum, who's the current president. But the officers, without any delay, say that our second day is probably the most powerful, because that's when they get to actually interact with people that have mental health conditions, and they get to see exactly what it is like for them.
What are those who say this is just kind of a glorified sensitivity training?
Well, I've heard that a lot. I've been a police officer for almost 28 years, but we've even had SWAT members come through who will admit at the end of the training that they say there was nothing like they thought it was going to be. I think a lot of officers think we're going to sit around, hold hands, and sing Kumbaya, which we disappoint a few, and we don't do that. However, what we do try to ensure is that they develop an understanding, and the byproduct of the training is many officers come forward to me and say, listen, this is my, you're talking about my mother, or this is my father, or my sister, or my brother, or some other relative. So it's a very enlightening experience that second day.
Dr. Officer Greg Sincere here with us in studios with San Jose Police and works with the Crisis Management Unit. And Mary Morgan is also with us this morning here in studio. She's a judge with San Francisco's Behavioral Health Court. And I should mention that the Behavioral Health Court is a voluntary program, and UCSF has done a whole study about it. It has had some real results, at least according to that study. It's safe to say, Judge Morgan, and I saw some of your work in operation. I commend you for the kind of kindness and empathy you've shown for people who come through your court. It's all about safety in many ways, isn't it, what you do?
Absolutely, it's about safety. I think the message for our behavioral health court, as well as I think the police officers have mm-hmm. learned, is that the most important thing you can do for someone who is mentally ill is get them into appropriate treatment. That's what protects the public. That's what protects the person who is mentally ill, the police officer on the beat, the families of the persons who are mentally ill, the victims of their crimes. So treatment is really the kernel of it.
Tell us a little bit how things take place. I mean, how the court works. Who comes in and what happens?
So almost anyone who has been arrested and charged with a crime is eligible for our behavioral health court. The first thing that happens is that they are screened by jail psychiatric services to make sure that they are diagnostically appropriate. That means typically a person is diagnosed with an Axis I mental illness, a severe mental illness. We deal primarily with the most impaired, most low-functioning people because resources are scarce.
Many of them with drug abuse problems, we should add, too, of course.
That is also true, but we also have a drug court which deals with people who are primarily drug addicted, and that's their primary diagnosis. For us, although there are many people who have what we call co-occurring diseases, both addiction and mental illness, for us, in our program, the primary diagnosis is mental illness. Almost any crime is accepted into our program with the exception of homicides and any kind of sex offense. However, there has to be an agreement among all the members of the team, the judge, the service providers, the district attorney, the public defender, that this person is appropriate, that the legal disposition that would allow them not to go to state prison but to remain in the community and have treatment is very important.
You also talk to the victims in many
cases. Absolutely. Every single case that comes into behavioral health court, the district attorney speaks with the victim. And I am very pleased to say that, in part because of public education, I believe, that 99.9% of all of the victims of crimes that come into behavioral health court are very enthusiastic about it. They are relieved to hear that the person who harmed them is going to get treatment so that another person would not be subject to that assault or that theft or whatever it was that occurred as a result of the mental illness.
Again, talking with Judge Mary Morgan from the San Francisco Behavioral Health Court, part of the San Francisco Superior Courts. Some of the criticism that one reads and hears is that medications or treatment are sort of compulsory once they enter into your domain, which is to say that the law can't impose that on them, but once they go to the behavioral court, it can at least recommend that, or they're going to be incarcerated. So the choice is not much if people don't want to be incarcerated. And what do you say to that argument, basically?
Well, I think the first thing is that the legal system doesn't make that decision. The service providers do. So that if a psychiatrist and other mental health service provider thinks that the appropriate treatment involves medication, then that's part of the treatment plan. There are also many other parts of the treatment plan. There is sometimes medication, not for everyone, but for some people when it's appropriate. There is also housing. There is other kinds of mental health treatment. In terms of therapy and group programs, there is education. Very important is supported employment. There are day treatment centers that people have access to all of the time. But I want to stress that it's a voluntary program. For some people, the option is incarceration, but that's their decision.
Case managers, central to this program.
Absolutely. They are the key to the program. And in particular, the case management program from UCSF called Citywide Case Management Forensics is key to our program. Supervision, daily contact, support, hand-holding, making sure that someone is where that person is supposed to be, accountability. That's all the role of the case manager, and they're essential.
Again, Judge Mary Morgan is with the San Francisco Behavioral Health Court as a judge, and that's part of the San Francisco Superior Courts. We also have Mark Gell with us now from Southern California, who chairs the Criminal Justice Committee with NAMI, the National Alliance on Mental Illness, in California. And Mark Gell, glad to have you aboard here. Good morning.
Good morning, everyone.
Morning.
This is, let's just talk in general about crisis intervention and the behavioral courts as you see it from a mental health standpoint. What kind of effect they're having? They're certainly spreading into other communities, and that's seen as a good thing in terms of the stigma of mental illness, in terms of getting people away from being incarcerated. Overall, is there a way to quantify it?
Well, I think what we're seeing is, I believe there's now, the number's either 39 or 41 different mental health courts in California, and we're going to try to track those numbers and see the expansion of mental health court programs. I missed the beginning of the show. I don't know if Greg mentioned how many CIT counties there are.
I mentioned several, but not enough, Mark. But.
Yeah, and you know, what we do as an advocacy organization with NAMI California, National Alliance on Mental Illness, is to encourage our state and our counties to implement more courts like Judge Morgan's, who does just tremendous work in San Francisco and coordinates a myriad of agencies that she works with to get people the help that they need and to participate in her program, and to encourage more and more counties to go CIT. You know, and there's some resistance out there to the training, some on an ideological basis. Oftentimes we find in talking to different police agencies around the state that sometimes it's a budgetary concern. They don't have enough money to do the 40 hours, but maybe only 16 or 24. But I think county by county, they're starting to see that it makes sense to go through this training and teach officers how to de-escalate. That exercise that you played earlier is actually, we do call it, actually, Michael, you hit it on the head. You said an empathy exercise. It's the empathy exercise from the NAMI Family to Family program. I have done continuing education at Twin Towers in the Los Angeles jail system to the sheriff deputies and custody assistants there. And we do this exercise for them the way Greg uses it in CIT training, not just to create empathy, but also to have officers understand. It's not so much that it's an exact simulation of what hearing voices with schizophrenia might be like, to sort of give the impression that how difficult it might be for either someone on the street or somebody in a jail to follow your first instruction, that you might have to repeat instructions. We want to keep people safe. We want officers to de-escalate, not escalate situations. We don't want people getting hurt. We don't want law enforcement officers being hurt, and we don't want patients being hurt or inmates inside the jail.
Two major principles in common law, right? Protect the safety of the public and protect the disabled, and those certainly are relevant, but also protect the police, as you've just mentioned.
Sure, absolutely. I mean, if they de-escalate a situation by handling it appropriately and getting someone to be calm and by having enough patience to maybe repeat their instructions two or three times and not just using force because they're not listened to first time out, then less people are going to get hurt.
We had Daryl Steinberg, California legislator's sponsor of Bill, the 2007 Second Chance Act. You saw this as a good thing. A lot of people in mental health work saw it as a good thing. It's gone down to defeat. Talk about that from your perspective.
Well, it's really unfortunate. He put through two bills. There was, I think it was 1651 2 years ago and SB 851. We encourage the presiding judges in the counties around California to expand mental health courts, programs like Judge Morgan. I'm familiar with four or five different judges around the state who I've had the privilege to meet and learn about how they do their program. Judge Morgan, there's in San Mateo, there's Stephen Manley, there's Judge Lindley in Orange County, Tara Riley in San Bernardino, Tom Anderson in Nevada County, and there's many, many more who I don't know their names off the top of my head. But there is some resistance, I think, to some presiding judges who view these as boutique or specialty courts. What we were hoping was Senator Steinberg's legislation, which we thought was a very good bill, to codify, to put in statute the standards, the eligibility criteria for a mental health court. As it was described to me, you know, judges now, like Judge Morgan, have to go to their presiding judge, and if some are against it, they will look at this as a specialty court or a boutique court, and there is resistance to it. And also budgetary concerns are always a problem as well.
Yeah, let me get Judge Morgan to comment on that, if you would, Mary Morgan.
Yes, I think there are still some presiding judge who see programs such as this as a what we call a boutique court, as if it's not carrying, the judge isn't carrying his or her load in the court, but just doing something that's marginal or peripheral. I think that's really becoming a view of the past. Most judges now recognize that these kinds of courts handle many, many cases, take them out of the trial system. They are extremely productive, but more importantly than just numbers, that these kinds of courts are now handling these cases in the most just and fair way, producing a good and fair result not only for the defendant, but for the victim and the families of all of those people, as well as the community at large.
And Greg Sancir, getting back to crisis intervention teams, a lot of lives saved, a lot of crises diffused.
Actually, yes, and as we were having the show here this morning, I bought an article from the San Jose Mercury News just from last week where I was called out with some of our officers that we trained, a couple of which were hostage negotiators, and they were also cross-trained in CAT techniques, and I got the call late and early on, and frankly, they didn't even need me. When I got there, they were handling the situation, and fortunately, got the gentleman down without further incident. The sad part about it is that this gentleman had attempted to take his own life earlier in the year in January, where we also successfully, one of our guys that was trained in CAT techniques, got him down. So what we're trying to ensure is that we see less people by having the CAT training. And also I should say that our CIT trained officers also become ambassadors, if you will, for mental health, because so many families, when there is a psychotic episode with one of their loved ones, are completely unaware of what's happening. So when we send our CIT officers out to a call like that, they're able to diffuse the situation. And then also they become an ambassador, as I mentioned, to mental health and where the families can get resources.
Well, they become educators, really.
Absolutely. Yes, they do.
And Kevin Pooler, you find that you're working with police, that they really are receptive, they're really open to learning and becoming ambassadors, educators, et cetera?
Yeah, you know, at the end of the panel, there's a luncheon, and I speak with a lot of officers during the luncheon, and it's amazing how many of them are really just genuinely interested in learning about mental illness. And, you know, I think one of the most abundant questions is, how can you tell the difference between someone that's maybe on street drugs and someone that is mentally ill? And, you know, I tell people that a lot of times you're going to come across people that are both. And, you know, it's just, you know, they are really genuinely interested.
Well, I think our listeners are probably interested in finding out more about what we're talking about or adding their voices to this discussion. So let me give you a number, and you can join us toll-free, whether you're listening to us on radio, Internet, or Sirius Satellite. We welcome your calls. It's 866-733-6786. Again, lines open and available to you. It's 866-733-6786, or send an email to forum@kqed.org. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking about the issue of the mentally ill in the criminal justice system and talking about new programs that are designed to help police and the courts avoid dangerous confrontations with the mentally ill. And these programs are designed to essentially bring the mentally ill into treatment rather than into incarceration. With us in studio is Mary Morgan, who is a judge with San Francisco's Behavioral Health Court, and Kevin Pooler, who is a schizophrenic who has had a number of run-ins in his history with the police and now works with the police in training seminars about what it feels like to be mentally ill and confronted by the police, and Greg Sancier, who is a PhD in clinical psychology and a San Jose police officer who works with the Crisis Management Unit. And with us by phone from Southern California is Mark Gale, who chairs the Criminal Justice Committee with the National Alliance on Mental Illness in California. Your calls are welcome, and again, you can join us toll-free at 866-733-6786 or by email, simply sending an email to forum@kqed.org, and we'll go to your calls and emails forthwith in just a moment. I want to go back to Greg Sancier, though, to talk about a little, if you would, investigative techniques. I mean, I think perhaps people are getting a challenge here thinking about a situation like this. Maybe somebody's gone out of control. There's mm-hmm. always the concern about violence or the mm-hmm. danger about violence and mm-hmm. is talking, you know, what people say on the street, talking crazy. Mm-hmm. The police and your unit comes out, and there are things that can go wrong very
Absolutely.
Easily. But you also have to make a very quick assessment,
Absolutely.
Almost on-the-spot assessment. And this seems to me, again, talk about techniques in terms of how you do that.
Well, the techniques are something that we try to go into detail on the last day of our training, which is, as most of us will agree as adults, we hate role-playing, if you've ever done any. But the officers, I think, to the person will agree that the most beneficial day other than the second day that I mentioned is the role-playing day where actually, if you will, they're put on the hot seat to learn the techniques. And I've been a hostage negotiator for over 20 years, so I've been on a number of incidents related to, you know, hostage takings and barricades and things of that nature. So what I try to do is impart some of my experiences with the officers going through the training, how they can de-escalate someone who's in crisis. But as I think Kevin mentioned so appropriately, one of the issues being that many times the people are very confused and they're fearful. And as the judge mentioned, if they have a co-occurring disorder, such as if they have street drugs on board, then you can see how problematic that would be, such as was the case last week, where despite our best efforts, when we send officers that are trained in these techniques, it takes a lot of fortitude to be able to, first of all, be safe, but also you have to realize that that person may have been ingesting all kinds of street drugs, and we have no knowledge of what they're taking. So what we try to do is establish that first line of communication, which is as simple as saying, hi, my name's Greg, what's your name? And what I try to do is always ensure that the officers understand you're trying to give someone back some dignity and respect, which is something that takes some skill, because if they're under the influence of something and they're also actively psychotic, as you mentioned during the exercise, if they're hearing those voices, it can be very, very problematic to try to communicate with them.
That goes also in the courtroom, doesn't it, Judge Morgan?
Oh, I think that's absolutely true. What we try to do in the courtroom is create an environment where people can come in, feel comfortable. For most people, it is the first time probably ever in their lives, unless they have had the experience that the officer is discussing, of someone in authority actually according them dignity and respect. I mean, we're talking about people who often find themselves absolutely at the bottom of the barrel. So part of what we do in behavioral health court is create an environment where they want to succeed because they want to have the applause that often comes from their peers if someone has done well. They want to be able to come back less frequently to court. They want to have the approval not only from me, the judge, what the person they perceive to be as the ultimate authority figure, but also from their case managers.
That's that sense of recognition, too, that's it comes to them so infrequently, if at all, mm-hmm. through a lifetime often of struggling against mental illness, and they get that sense of feeling their personhood, really, I guess, don't they?
I think that's absolutely true. For instance, I was thinking just a second ago, I don't see Mr. Pooler as a schizophrenic. I see him as a young man who I'm sure has many things and aspects
Oakland A's
in
fan,
his life.
In fact, yeah.
Yes, Oakland A's, I'm sorry to say, since you're here in San Francisco. And he also happens to have a mental illness. And so how we deal with people in behavioral health court is really based on a recovery model where mental health treatment is only one aspect of what we try to give to people so that they can live productive lives. Employment, education, volunteer opportunities, reunification with families, help with their children, all of those things go into it.
Now, Kevin Pooler, when you were having the struggle with your schizophrenia, it was certainly, despite the stigma of schizophrenia that unfortunately is all too much a part of our society, It was easier, I imagine, to cope with that than it was to be tossed into incarceration.
Yeah.
To be labeled a prisoner, to be labeled a criminal, in other words.
And luckily, I never offended to the point where I was incarcerated for very long. But the great thing is that there are drugs out there, prescription medication that people can take that will allow them to live near normal lives. And I would encourage anyone that's going through any type of problems related to mental illness to seek help for medication. And, you know, it's a type of thing where a lot of the drugs that you need to get on immediately to get rid of some of the symptoms, the side effects are a little negative. But the good thing is...
Sometimes more than a little negative.
But the thing is it will stop you from hearing voices, and it will stop the delusions. And what's then available are other drugs with less side effects, and you can progressively step down the regimen to where you're on medication that is effective but has little to no side effects.
But like many people who suffer mental illness, you didn't know you were mentally ill, really, did you?
No, I did not.
Well, let me get a caller's involved in this discussion, and we begin with Honor as our first caller. Good morning.
Good morning.
Hi, you're on the air. Join us, please.
My comment was, I've had a 13-year-old who quit. I've had a hostile life twice in the past couple months for anger, rage, and probably a new diagnosis of bipolar. And I find that when he's in the hospital, there's a lot of intervention and attention. And then, though, he's discharged much too early back to the same environment, you know, my house, the same triggers. And he never learns enough coping skills for the next episode. So, in other words, he's just intervened upon when there's a crisis instead of more of a prevention, similar to health care and acute hospital care.
Well, we certainly need, in fact, let me go to you on this, Mark Gale, and get your sense. It just speaks to how much we need more funding for mental health and for mental health institutions, doesn't it?
The problem begins with access to care, and how she's able to treat her 13-year-old child is dependent on which system she's being able to access. If she has private insurance, mostly what private insurers have to offer are medications, copays for seeing a psychiatrist, and so many therapy appointments a year, usually 20 to 50 at a subsidized rate. But there's not much through private insurance past that. There's no day patient programs or discharge planning or anything like that. If you're accessing the county system, there are more of those programs. I'm not a specialist in adolescent care, but if she's accessing the public system, she should talk to Children's Services with the Department of Mental Health in her area and to see what other day patient programs, classes, groups are available to try to get some extra assistance.
Well, good luck to her, and Honor, thank you for your call. I'm going to go to more of your calls. Tom, you're on. Good morning.
Good morning, Michael. I have a comment and a quick question. I think it's really commendable and really urgently needed to have these kinds of programs. And it's really commendable what the judge and the police officers and the professionals in this program are doing. But I was thinking, you know, we live in a legacy of a period when a lot of the people were basically thrown away from the healthcare system, and we're still living under that legacy. And I wonder what percentage of criminals out there and violent criminals out there are actually discovered to be or not discovered to be mentally ill. And so I have a question for the judge. Why is homicide and sexual assault criminals excluded from this program?
Judge Morgan?
Homicides and sexual assaults are excluded from this program because typically the mandatory penalty, if in fact they're guilty of the crime, is state prison. So we only deal with people who can be treated safely in the community.
Caller has a point, though, that homicide and sexual assaults may be related indeed to mental illness.
Oh, that is absolutely true, and that may be a defense that is mounted so that the person is found not guilty.
Well, since Dan White, it's been a difficult defense to mount. It used to be the diminished capacity defense, of course, I don't think there have been all that many successful diminished capacity. Am I right about this, Greg Sincere, in recent years?
Well, that's true. But also I'd like to mention that I think that it's important for people to know that people with mental health conditions are often victimized far more than the general population. And additionally, a concern of ours in law enforcement is that, and NAMI members, I think Mark will agree with this, is that people with mental illness are not more violent than those people in the general population. I know there's been studies recently of which one I got from the National Institute of Mental Health said that in a six-month period, people that were diagnosed with schizophrenia may have had one incidence of violence, and more specifically with family members, but there's still nothing definitive that says people with mental illness are more violent than those that are not diagnosed.
You see a lot of people out on the street who obviously need to be institutionalized, and yet, you know, the minority are really, I think, dangerous either to themselves or to others, but still need to be cared for. The nation's largest psychiatric facility, this is just for listeners, is not a psychiatric facility. It's New York's Rikers Island. There are some 3,000 inmates at any one time there. And you also ought to know that a half century ago, there were 600,000 state hospital beds in the nation. You know how many there are now? 40,000. So those kind of stats speak for themselves, I think, don't they, Mark Gale?
Yeah, and to answer the caller's question about percentages, in an older study, I believe from the late 90s, 16%, and it was considered about 20% in California, of prison inmates had a serious mental illness. Based on a 2004 study recently released, the number nationally was more like, I believe, 45 to 50%. The Twin Towers is also the second largest behind Rikers, as far as I know, in terms of being a psychiatric facility. And, you know, you bring up a point about being danger to self or others. I think our Landerman Petra Short Act, or LPS Act, my personal feeling is very much at root cause of the criminalization of persons with mental illness. The dangerous standard is so high that by the time the system is able to intervene for someone in order to get them help, the bar is set so high at the dangerous standard that by the time they've reached the dangerous standard, they've usually committed an offense, and now they've been criminalized. And the point is to give people access to treatment so they don't get criminalized in the first place. If in an idealistic world, they'd never make it to Judge Morgan's courtroom.
Right.
They would get the treatment and care that they need. We have a law on the books called AB 1421, known as Laura's Law, modeled after New York's law, Kendra's Law, which is not being utilized around the state, that could help those most in need who are not getting care at all because they're not going into the clinics voluntarily. They are not being helped by Mental Health Services Act services, who could be treated under court-ordered assisted outpatient treatment and hopefully get the care they need prior to committing a crime so they would never be criminalized in the first place.
Yeah, Judge Morgan, let me get you to comment on this, if I could.
Well, I think, certainly there are plenty of people in San Francisco who have contact with the criminal justice system who can be very dangerous from time to time. It's very important to realize that a mental illness typically waxes and wanes. A person isn't static all of the time. So that there are times when a person should be in a treatment facility that is locked and secure for the safety of that person as well as the public. I would say one of the many problems that we have is there simply aren't enough beds that can adequately take care of these kinds of people and not have them in jail. What happens typically, I think Mr. Gale is absolutely correct, that so many people get arrested and the criminal justice system becomes the treatment facility of last resort. And that simply is not fair to the public and taxpayers. It is not fair to the person who is mentally ill, and it is certainly not fair to the people who and the sheriff's deputies who have to work in the jail.
Well, Officer Sincere, they say when a police officer has to play the street corner psychiatrist, which to some extent is what we're talking about here. He has choice, or she has a choice, of transporting the person to a mental hospital, arresting them, or resolving it informally. And in many cases, there really isn't the prerogative to take that person to a mental hospital.
Well, you know, and that's absolutely true. And unfortunately, I couldn't agree more with the judge. But I've even instructed our officers to, you know, if you can get someone for a misdemeanor and they're not currently getting any services, to unfortunately, yes, arrest them, because in Santa Clara County Jail, we have 8A, which is the psych facility in the jail. So at least then we know that maybe their incarceration will lead to them getting assessed, which they've never been done so before. And then hopefully with some help, get to Judge Manley's court. And we also use our DAs, Dana Overstreet and Vonda Tracy, who I work with quite closely on cases related to people with mental illness, to try to ensure that the adjudication process leads them through Judge Manley's court, if at all possible. But I think Mark Gale probably, I mean, I don't know how many people are aware of Prop 63. I don't know if that's something you want to ask him about and what it does. But
you want to talk about that, Mark Gale?
On the Mental Health Services Act is primarily voluntary-only services. The purpose of the act is to really transform the mental health system. The way the law was written was that you could not use the new money, which was the 1% tax on millionaires, to supplant existing realignment funds that pay for our core mental health system. And what I think personally is transpiring is we continue to get more budget cuts in the traditional funding for the Department of Mental Health in each county and through the state. So the core system, and by core I mean that's your local clinics, your hospitals. Judge Morgan referred to, we don't have enough beds. Beds are closing. I know Sonoma County just lost their last 12 beds. This is a catastrophe when there's nowhere to get someone out of a psych ER and put them in a longer-term facility where they can get the help that they need. So that core system, unfortunately, due to budget cuts, is deteriorating. And at the same time, you have the governor vetoing the AB 2034 program, which is, as far as I'm concerned, a complete disaster because it was helping 4,700 people around the state. And then the Mental Health Services Act is great. So you're building Cadillac services for a lucky few, but the core system that's still serving the multitudes is in a deteriorating posture fiscally. So at some point, hopefully, we will get it together so we can merge the services that are being created from the Mental Health Services Act into the core system and not have a two-tiered system.
Apropos of that, Elizabeth, one of our listeners in Oakland, says wanted our guests to discuss the lack of mental health services, which I think we've just done. And she says, it seems like the courts are attempting a Band-Aid on something that the legislature should be dealing with. But then she goes on also to say, I observed Judge Morgan's court last month and was amazed at her connection with the defendants. I'm a law student and have observed many domestic violence courts, and this was a huge difference. I think the behavioral health courts are a great system and should be utilized as much as possible. The fact that the courts are attempting to deal with the root problem rather than just the end result is life-changing for people. And another listener, Cheryl, says, I'd like to comment about the use of the term schizophrenic instead of has schizophrenic. I think she means has schizophrenia. The former gives the impression that this is a character flaw that the person cannot do anything about. The latter gives the correct impression that this is an illness that requires treatment and can be controlled. I think that changing the way mental illness is talked about contributes greatly to reducing the stigma. Some thoughts, Kevin Pooler, on that?
Either way, it doesn't really bother me. I think just the word schizophrenic is important because it is a very grave illness, and I think that to speak of it in any term is necessary, just because I don't really worry about exactly how it's phrased, because I know that just using the term schizophrenic is gonna convey what exactly is going on.
Though we should mention there are four types of schizophrenia. This gets back to psychiatry 101. And there's hebephrenic and catatonic and simple schizophrenia, but mostly we're talking about paranoid schizophrenia when we're talking about the kind of problems that confront police officers. Greg Sincere, we're also talking, as we said, about drugs. We're talking about post-traumatic stress syndrome.
Yes, sir.
Just a whole range of bipolar. You can almost go through the clinical list, can't you?
Well, and that's especially true, but especially in these times when we're having a war in Iraq, we're finding now, and I'd be remiss if I didn't mention this, but the troops that we're seeing that have traumatic brain injury and PTSD are coming back now, and we find ourselves in a national crisis, and I think the VA will agree to that. Recently had the opportunity to attend the National Center for PTSD in Menlo Park, where they're with open arms are welcoming these troops back. And certainly in the city of San Jose, we've had a number of incidents related to some of these conditions, which one of the terms you're going to hear is polytrauma. And I'm also proud to say we're working with the Services for Brain Injury with Dr. David Masucci in San Jose and the VA to try to get together to determine how we best can serve our troops as they return.
From Burlingame, Conrail, good morning.
Good morning. In my experience, I've noticed that law enforcement has been very good about identifying people with a mental illness and bringing them in on a 5150, I think it's usually called. But what are the tools that they have? I mean, often the people that they take in exhibit a lot of kind of paranoid speech about their immediate surroundings, scared of their family, scared of people. How can they determine whether or not the kind of paranoid ideation is real and whether or not not only are they mentally ill, but are they possibly also endangered, and are they safe to be released back into their environment?
Greg sits here.
Well, that's especially difficult when you're coming upon someone like in crisis, such as we had the gentleman on the bridge last week. We try to make as many assessments as we can, and part of that is trying to elicit the help from the mental health courts, the mental health system, to see if anyone's aware of the individual. Certainly, if we've had previous contacts, that helps us as well. But the problem is one of, once again, if someone has a co-occurring disorder, we try to make as many assessments as we can on the scene, but the scene I'm going to call is a dynamic one, which is constantly changing. A lot of clinicians get upset with me because I discuss my environment as being out there. Well, what's out there mean? Well, it can be on a bridge. It can be in the 12th story of a building. So it's not a clinical environment. So
those kind of snap decisions, I mean, you have people who, psychiatrists who've gone into penitentiary and talked at length with various felons and people who are behind bars and tried to determine, are they a risk as far as parole, or are they a risk in terms of the causation behind their behavior? And sometimes it's just indeterminate, let alone, you know, making a snap decision.
Well, that's correct. And in my world, I have yet to be come across someone in 15, 20 years of doing some of this work that I've yet to come across someone. The term used to be called dually diagnosed. Now I know the term is a co-occurring disorder, but in my world, that person doesn't exist. So what we're trying to do is make sense of hallucinations, delusions, of chemicals they may have on board, trying to make sense of what the issue is that led them to be on that bridge or that overpass. So it's a luxury in my world to be able to make sense of many of those things that are happening.
Okay. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Mark.
If I might interject something, I mean, it doesn't help Greg in the field, but once someone is incarcerated, I developed an inmate medication information form that was approved by the Los Angeles Department of Health and the Los Angeles Sheriff's Department, which is being used at probably, I don't know, a dozen jails around California. We're actually in a project with NAMI California's Criminal Justice Committee, encouraging every clinical supervisor in every jail in the state to use the form, which can to have it placed on the Sheriff's Department website and DMH website. So once the person is booked and has a booking number and it can be identified that way, the family can print out the form and send in clinical information about any kind of psychiatric meds, psychiatric illness, diagnosis, whether suicide is a concern, whether violence is a problem, if there's any other medical conditions, such as cancer or diabetes or anything else that the jail should know about. And at least the clinicians working inside the jail can then have some immediacy of information from the family, and also would be provided outside doctors' contact numbers so they could verify the information with a physician.
And again, Mark Gale chairs the Criminal Justice Committee for the National Alliance on Mental Illness here in California, and we're going to take more of your calls. Malika, good morning.
Well, good morning, Michael. First of all, please accept my compliments on doing an exceptional job. I've been listening to your program for over 5 years now. This is the first time I've called in. So,
thank you for that.
And I have a comment and then a question. My comment is I worked as a case manager at the Santa Clara County, and I had occasion to deal with the CIT officers who were often called on board to my facility, and did an exceedingly good job about trying to de-escalate the situation. And now my question is, I am currently in Sacramento, and I work as a clinician with the Sacramento County. I have a personal situation where my stepson is incarcerated, and I have seen patterns and indicators of obvious mental illness. I mean, he's a young adult, not even 20 yet, and his situations have just escalated from petty occurrences and incidences to once he became an adult, he has been charged with felony crimes. And I was wondering if there were any facilities or any resources available, like Judge Morgan's in San Francisco, in Sacramento County, that perhaps we could make available for him.
There a court like we have here in San Francisco in the state capitol, Mary Morgan?
I don't believe so, but I do think it would be extremely important for you as the family to share all of that information with your son's lawyer.
Any advice about what she can do now that he's been charged with a felony?
And currently incarcerated, of course.
And incarcerated, Greg Sincere?
Yes.
Well, one of the big issues that I try to confront with family members is, number one, the family-to-family training that NAMI presents is absolutely outstanding. Number two is what your son is going to be confronted with is admitting that he is becoming or has a mental illness. And as I think Michael mentioned earlier, for people to recognize that has become its stigma unto itself, that their inability to recognize that they have a mental illness. So what I try to ensure when I get calls from family members is I try not to make it a matter of mental illness, because that indicates some flaw of their being or their affects their intellect or something of that nature. What I try to do is appeal to them to ask that loved one, tell me, based on what's going on with you in your life, how do you see the quality of your life right now? And that takes away the stigma of mental illness, but actually allows that person to make a judgment based on, if they're lucid at that point, which I would hope they would be able to say at that point, actually, my quality of life isn't that great because look at where I am. Exactly. And I think Kevin will maybe Kevin, you could comment on that as well, because Kevin came to an epiphany in his life where he realized if he didn't get help, he was going to die, and his father was instrumental in that.
Kevin, want to say a word about that as we close the hour here?
Yeah, you know, I was really confused, and I was really sick, and I thought people were after me and trying to kill me.
Yes.
And people offered me medication, and you know, I didn't exactly know how taking medication was going to help me from not being killed. But I started taking the medication, hoping that somehow that would happen, and you know, it did.
It's a good endorsement for the help of pharmaceuticals. Thank you, Kevin Pooler, for joining us this hour. Thanks to Mary Morgan of the San Francisco Behavioral Health Court, and thanks to Greg Sincere for the San Jose Police Force, and Mark Gale of NAMI, the National Alliance on Mental Illness. And thanks to you, our listeners. We appreciate your being with us here. We're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, and hours repeated 10 to 11 in the evening. Want to also thank our senior editor, Dan Zoll, and our producers, Kevin Guillory and Judy Campbell. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Forum's executive producer is Raul Ramirez. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation, and the Bernard Osher Foundation, supporting higher education and the arts.